All right, so we are beginning to have our study for tonight. We are going to be continuing the second half of a bit of a visual and historical overview of Israel. We'll get into the second half of that look here in just a moment. Before we get into the class, though, let's take a moment and bow our heads together in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessings that we share and find in Jesus. We hope as servants and students of your Son and the Word that you provide for us wisdom and a rich grounding in our faith. Help us to be encouragers. Help us to be focused on heaven and watch over our souls. And this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so as I want to kind of restructure a couple of things. This is part two of what is kind of an overview of a recent trip to Israel for me, but maybe just helpful in other ways as we try to tie together some of these archaeological sites and historical places to our culminating studies of the history of Israel. If you've got questions and you feel like you've got something, hey, what about this, that, or the other? Please just raise your hand and interrupt whatever I'm saying with your question because I can try to answer it. We can come back to whatever I was talking about, or I can say, I don't know, we'll talk about that another time. So it's perfectly okay to ask any questions you might have as we look through this. We're going to be going at a modestly fast pace to kind of make sure we get through this second half on schedule. I won't make that bold commitment that we'll get through it all in one night like I did last time, because obviously it took two nights to get through this, but we'll be good. Right now, though, let's see where we're at. So just a quick reminder on the historical side of what we're seeing and recognizing here. We're paying attention to Israel across a large time space, in that we're looking at everything from their occupation of the land until the arrival of Jesus. So that's about more than 1,000 years. What is interesting, though, is that in some ways, not a lot of this archaeologically changes. There's a lot of the same places. There's a lot of the same structures. In the historic range of time that we're talking about, this is almost all Iron Age, if you're looking at it in your academic history books. And so you're going to find, with that kind of clumping together, a lot of sameness. That is, how it was culturally, archaeologically, and historically during the time of David did not change substantially as you arrive in the time of Jesus when it comes to the structures. Did the dominating powers change? Yes. Did the way they interacted with the nations around them change? Yes. That doesn't change the dirt and the rocks too much. That's all basically the same. And a lot of this region is very similar in its topography and physical structures because there's only a little bit of stuff you can use to build things with. So a lot of this is very similar in that regard. Day one, we came to Jerusalem. Day two, this is the gas station shot. This is a gas station near one of the couple of places where the Ark of the Covenant rested independent of the tabernacle spaces. This one happens to be Elvis themed. This is the current modern Jerusalem. Looking in this space, you're looking at a picture that if you were turning around and you're actually viewing all of this, to your right is the Mount of Olives. Down this valley space right here, this is all defiled land. It's all burial grounds. So that means that it cannot be used and functioned in a context for religious Jews anymore. That burial space, this section right here, is predominantly Jewish burial sites. These are all Israelites of various eras, mostly more modern. As you get closer to the Temple Mount here, that turns into a Muslim graveyard space, and they're actively in use today. So they have burials taking place in this more Jewish section and over in the Muslim section close to the Temple Mount on the other side of this valley space. This is the location of Shiloh. It was the spiritual center of Israel until David. This is where the tabernacle rested. We don't know exactly if this particular patch of earth is the exact location of where the tabernacle was, but it's one of the few spaces that is legitimately Shiloh, that's flat and level, and about the right size. And so this is most likely where the tabernacle would have been set. That brings us just very quickly to Beersheba. This is a couple of bits and pieces from our time looking at this fort structure. Beersheba is a common place in a number of the biblical stories. We'll talk about a few of them in a second. Beersheba is two words. B-E apostrophe E-R, Sheba or Sheba. And it means one of two things because it's a little bit variable in the wording. It either means well of the seven wells, or seven people, or it means well of the oath, because that second word can mean either of those things, depending on how it's used. Now, what's interesting, though, is that this city here actually has a bunch of wells, and so it's very likely that it's the city of seven wells, or the well of the seven in that regard. In this same space, location here in Beersheba, this is where Abraham made a pact with Abimelech, the king of Gerar, and Isaac would dig a well there, likely one of the ones that they still have potentially in use. As you're looking at the city on the slide that's up here, this position right here is on a big tower they built. So you can look down on the city, and you notice that long, wide middle street here on the chart right there. As it goes straight out to a gate off on the edge of the screen, the gate's on that side right there, there is a large well right there. That well looks just like this. This is what the wells look like. This is a reconstruction of its condition, probably middle Iron Age. So you're looking somewhere around 500 to 700 BCE time frame. And much like any other well you've ever seen, they kind of look the same. You've got your structure keeping it safe on the outside, your rock structure, and you got to have some way to get the water up because they're not pumping it up, right? And so almost all of these wells are hand-powered wells in this area. They function in one of two ways. Either they use some level force of mechanical advantage to pull something up, either a pulley system, which is very common, or simply a rope over a stick or a branch, which does the same thing. Or the wells that are in fortifications, those have stairwells going down. And those spiraled stairs, you go to the bottom, the creek bed, the river bed, whatever water source is down there, and you stick your bucket in, you pull it up, and you walk up the steps. In some of the fortresses, the first job of the day for about half of the people that lived there would be to go down into the well, gather water up for the day, multiple trips if necessary. If you think about history in America, pre-plumbing, that's pretty much how we did it here, too. So, you know, in advance of plumbing inside of homes, first job of the day, make sure the fire's going. Second job of the day, make sure you got water. You also see at this particular fort a typical gate system in this area. We're just kind of showing some of these things in the gate space here. All of the gates in the fortified cities of this area served at least two primary purposes. Number one, these gates are designed to help protect the people when they're hiding inside. The entire area's communities would come inside of them in war, and so they needed to have a choke point to make it hard to get into the cities. But there's a second purpose for them, because at the city gates is where everybody interacts with everybody else. So we'll see this a couple times. I think I've got a couple other looks into these different settings. At the city gates, you find two things there. Number one, you find a seat. And who sat at the gate of the city according to our readings of the Bible?
The elders.
The elders. That's the leaders of those communities in general terms. As they got bigger, it would be a court official, often in that same role. But the other thing you find there are priests. Various priests hung out around the city's gates, most often to engage in two types of blessings. When it was an Israelite city and they were trying to follow Yahweh, these were free services where they could offer sacrifices before their journeys. In the pagan cities, when you find one of these cities excavated, There are multiple sites where you can obviously tell these were priestly settings. And you know what they find in the bottom of those digs very often in those priestly spaces? Coins. Because those were for pay. A lot of small wall inset shrines like I showed 2 weeks ago. The one that Luke Chandler's team of archaeologists he was working with excavated basically a box and a wall. They'd have a shrine that was a box on the wall where they'd offer to whatever local deity in these pagan cities to offer a blessing before you go, and you pay your tax. You pay your travel tax as an offering. In all the cities that you see everywhere, and I'll show this, this is what these things would have looked like during the time of its occupation, but there's tons of storehouses because these were fortified cities designed to go hide in when you're being under siege. That particular structure looks like that. So the archaeologists excavate all the rocks, and we'll show this. I think I've got a couple pictures of it in this next site or the site afterwards. When you go to one of these sites and you see they've rebuilt everything, in some cases, what you'll see is a two-stage rebuild, where the bottom stage is left exactly as they found it. And then they'll put some sort of marking line underneath it, and then they rebuild what the rest of it would have looked like. They do that for a number of reasons, but they want to show you what it would have looked like full size, but they're also telling you some of this is more modern, and we've rebuilt it back into its position. Tel Arad has, I think, a spot like that here in a second, as another tell does. Tells are basically just an archaeological site. Tell means large mound. And so every historical site in Israel basically exists as a big dirt mound that they dig out. Very similar to the archaeological site south of Atlanta or north of Atlanta that's an Indian mound. But actually there is history underneath that large clump of dirt. Here's another fortified city here in Tel Arad. This is interesting. It's a high place in the rising space of the history of Judah. It's a Judite kind of fortress setting. And inside of it, there is a small space of worship that's all temple space that they've excavated and pulled all of the remains of its temple worship use there. And you can see it in this kind of drawing here. This is a representation up here of the temple worship space. The interesting part of it is that it's the exact ratioed dimensions of the temple and the tabernacle. So they laid it out the same way. They put all the same kind of locational settings, and here's the actual site itself. You can kind of see in this photo that they've got on the lower section some marking lines behind where these folks are standing right in front of Luke. There's some marking lines very low to the ground. And a few other sites will show you they're even more pronounced. They've actually drawn a black line to help you see those things here at Tel Achish. Tel Achish is another historical site that's it's super interesting in a number of ways. One of the things that might be interesting to each of us is of the historical sites in Israel, this particular one, for reasons I don't know, like there's no actual rationale for it, has had the largest number of members of the Church of Christ work on as volunteers. Like it's not even a set, like there's no second place. You have individuals who have been professors at various universities in the U.S. who are members of the church. They've all worked at the site. They've actually published research at these various locations. You can see on this chart here, this is from the site itself, so it's like one of their little signs that say, go follow the place. But you see number four is? Number four is like right in the middle of the map up there. You guys kind of see where that is. I can pull the pointer out if it makes it easier for you. But at that particular site, number four location, Phil Roberts, Farrell Jenkins, and Tom Hamilton. Tom Hamilton is a current professor at Florida College, did some work there. But Farrell Jenkins taught there for years, wrote for years. You probably used him as Bible material. And Phil Roberts, who's passed away, did a ton of research there. There are two other sites that you can view from this location. They're only about 4 or 5 miles away. And when you see them, to my knowledge, now you've gotten to every site, major site that I know of, that members of the church that I know have dug at and done research at. You could do that yourself, too. If you wanted to be an archaeologist for a week, you can fly over there. They'll teach you what to do, and you can play in the dirt for a week. Archaeology is basically just digging around slowly and carefully. And then you bring it to someone who knows something, and they say, nope, that's just another piece of dirt. And you go back about your business. And if you like doing that, you can certainly do so. All right, so included with that, we've got some bits and pieces that help us understand what's going on in this particular city. These are the Lachish letters. These are contemporary to biblical events that help us understand the story of the destruction of this city involving Israel and Judah and the nations around it. And so this is one of the points where we can say history and archaeology closely align with the biblical text to one of the highest degrees you're going to find, because we get names and places that are contemporary to other information sources that tie together to Lachish's rise and fall, particularly the Assyrians who destroy this city. They built another assault ramp to crawl up in there. And I think you can actually see it here in this particular image here. And so they dug this entire assault ramp that goes up on the side to be able to get access and take over the big city. Pretty common behavior for them to get victory. This is something that I saw at the site that I just thought was super interesting. This is a visual way that Israel chooses to represent the kings who were ruling over the course of their history. And what you have here is every single major king identified of the length of their reign by the height of their chair. And I was like, that's really cool. And so I had to try to fight my way to get a good picture of it. But they're all in order. And now you can, we talked before, this is a lot of time before, what were our key concepts to know if we had a good king or a bad king? Length of reign. What was our key number we were looking for? 40 was like a really good king in that context. What they did with the high places? Did they put them up or did they take them down? You know, and that's what we kind of look at. Well, you can kind of see, well, where were the good kings and where are the bad kings? And kind of get an idea of that from our chair diagram that identifies the quality of their reign and the type of their reign. These are all post-Solomonic context. And so really helps us get an idea of kind of what's going on there. The next site we went to is on the next day. This is in Jericho. Jericho is interesting because it is the most compressed site of any of them. I like to use the illustration that archaeology in this context is like lasagna because it's a bunch of layers. Well, they used to think that Jericho represented about 22 layers of history. That means that 22 times it had been destroyed and then rebuilt. Recent archaeology has pointed out that there's actually like 36 or 37 layers there. So that's because of where Jericho is located. It's at a crossroads. So everyone has to drive over it to get to somewhere else. And this little city site is elevated. And so if you take the region over, what do? Well, you got to get that spot. All right, we got to go to Jericho. Got to squish it again. And they build another one on top of it. Here you have, in this particular location, is a picture of a potential base of one of the tower spaces that could have been time of conquest. It's hard to know for sure because they're trying to work with a very narrow band of dates when they're trying to say, okay, when was this? We're not talking picking between 100 years, 200 years. It's more like 50 to 10 years. I'm trying to figure it out. But this is potentially contemporaneous to the destruction of the city brought about by the Israelites when they brought into ownership that land. Let's go forward in time a little bit. Here's our sycamore tree. It's there in Jericho. And some of us know Paul and Laura Hammonds. That's Paul Hammonds standing behind me. He's not as tall as me by any standard. And I'm blocking the way for the poor little guy. Like, he's probably below my shoulders if we're side by side. So that's, we're there for scale. And so, hey, you know, it's like, get out of the way. I make a good door. I don't really make a good window. But there's a sycamore tree that's actually what it looked like. So you're wondering, like, what's a sycamore tree? What was going on? Looks like that. This next set of photos is from probably my second favorite spot to visit in Israel. My first favorite spot is Galilee, by far. Sea of Galilee, 100% top of my list. It's totally awesome. Bet Shen is a great illustration of what it means to be in Israel. So Bet Shen is a site that includes archaeology from Egypt, Israel, Greece, Rome, and everything in between. And they're all kind of next to each other in ways that make it super interesting. So here, you got a Roman colonnades. That's because at the time of its last use, it was a Roman colony. And every Roman military colony was laid out exactly the same. So its roads look exactly the same in every one of the cities. Where all the shops are all the same. And this is one of the major thoroughfares. If you're standing right where this photo was taken, well, two photos kind of squished together, to your right are the Roman baths. Or to your left, that is, were the Roman baths. You can go over there and get cleaned up after your long journey. If you go down to where they intersect, that's where all your mercantile would be. But if you go a little further down that road, you would see this big mound. It's a tell, right? Well, this tell here in Bet Shen is at the base of what is in our Bibles, records for us where Saul and Jonathan's bodies were hung by the Philistines in 1 Samuel 31. Then they were eventually retrieved and properly buried a little bit later. This is the same place where men were massacred by the other Israelite tribes in Judges 21. And so this is the same location. If you ask, like, where did that happen? Well, it happened here before it looked like this in the Davidic times. And so this big tell here, that covers up what would have been the fortress during the time of David. And so that's our time, you know, space there. Super interesting to kind of see all of that laid out for us and have a good understanding of how these cultures laid over one another. Also, I'll back this up. We'll probably see a different side of it in another location. To the right of this photo, past the little blue orbs, my right, I guess, there are one of the traditional amphitheaters that you see all throughout the Roman Empire, much like one of the ones that Paul would have potentially spoken in, and Philip. Question on how they moved all this stuff around without machinery gets answered right here. This is a common means of them moving these large stones around. They just hook on two wheels at the end, roll it along. You get enough labor, everything becomes easy. All right, so next spot we go to is the Herod Spring. This is the site where God has his people shrink down their army. And what's the standard that is used to determine whether or not you're going to go and fight? When the men get to the water, what are the options? Right, so they were wanting them to be like really aware. They have to kind of crouch down and do that. So am I going to get to go?
No.
No. But I'll tell you, that was the best move of the day because I felt fantastic after that. It was definitely hot and dry and all those things. And that water was super refreshing. 100% do it again. Nobody else wanted to dive in with me. I think, actually, take it back. Daniel Chandler also took the full plunge and experienced the greatness of the water as well, one of Jesse's friends. So this right here, this is currently my favorite spot in Israel. This is on a dock right on the edge of the Sea of Galilee at about 5 in the morning at sunrise. Just spectacular. And it's hard to get past the simple reality. There's nowhere else in Israel that's most certainly unchanged than the Sea of Galilee. It's the same water. same sea. Sometimes when you're there, the wind will kick up, and this calm water turns into an absolute mess. And so you can see all of that. Here's an olive tree and a shoot that's popping out of it, much like you have in the prophetic works of the prophets, telling us about the future of Israel. This particular one is in the site that we're at, which is a recreation of Bethlehem. So this isn't archaeologically Bethlehem. It is representational Bethlehem. The right place, right location, right style, but it's all modern build because it's a teaching tool. This was built there in Israel from donors and from the historical societies in Israel to say, hey, what was it like? What was first century Israel like? What did it look like? And so this is part of that exhibit of interest for us is the wine press and the olive press. So this right here is one of their presses. This is kind of how they work and how they function. It's a group effort. And so they're using, in this case, those additional weights to pull down on the levered arm to create the extra pressure. For olive pressing, they're going to do 4 or 5 pressings. As you get through lower and lower pressings, you get lesser and lesser quality olive oil. That's kind of how they do it now today. So if you go to the store and you see like they've got like 5 or 6 different price points of olive oil, it basically means, is it the freshy fresh or the last possible stuff that you can get off of it? Well, they charge you accordingly even today. And so this is how it takes place in the first century. This large vat down there where the weights are held is also where they would hold some of the residual olive oil ore. And some other locations, the same press method is used, and they would hold the wine excess, the juice extract of the grapes, as they were processing it for various purposes. Pause while I breathe. Questions? I didn't see any hands go up, and so I'm kind of making sure I'm staying on pace, but I do have to breathe sometimes. All right, moving forward. This is a look into one of the excavated synagogues. This one's unique because this one and one other one that we'll look at in just a second are of the highest likelihood for Jesus to have stood and taught in. You're never going to know for sure. Like, it's really, like, some of these synagogues, like, you can't, like, say absolutely sure, but if you're saying, like, what level of confidence do you have that this one would have been there, close to where he lived, and likely a place where someone like him would have gone? Well, this one, and most certainly the next one. The next one has even a higher likelihood. If this were percentages, like 90, 95% here, 99% for the next one. And you can see some things to help you understand the structure of worship in the first century. All of these synagogues are squared off, and they're seated in the round. And so we like to do things where we have this long row, right? Well, for the synagogues, everything is designed to face one another and to face in. And that the person was going to be reading, like I'm a pretty sure when Rich teaches class, he's probably going to be right there next Wednesday night. That's kind of his spot. It's almost like he's creating a little mini synagogue there where everyone has to kind of look in a little bit. But that's kind of how you would have it. Because you see in the middle of it, they've got a small little stone sitting there. That's the table upon which they would set the scrolls. And so if you're going to read, one of the helpers, the assistants, the priests, whomever might be in that role, would come and grab one of the scrolls, bring it out, put it out there. And if you're going to read, you have to go right there and read publicly in front of everybody in that regard. Which leads me to this synagogue, which is in the city of Capernaum. And what's interesting about this one is you can look at it. It's a modern synagogue now, but like modern relative to Roman era. You'll see this darker rock right here. That's the bedrock space that is contemporary to the time of Jesus when the synagogue was there. They just had to move it and build it up a little bit as the city rose up. And so Jesus would have most likely, including the apostles, including Peter, would have gone and been involved in that particular synagogue. This is in the city of Capernaum, which became the centerpiece of Jesus' ministry for about 2 years. And so you're saying, where was Jesus? Most likely he was there. Fishing community, the disciples were there. Some of their mothers were there. It was also one of the most documented earliest church assembly buildings in the Middle East, in Israel, exists about 100 yards from this synagogue. And now it's an archaeology site with a reflection space elevated by poles above it. Not an active church, but you can go in there and pray if you wanted to above the archaeological site. All right, so this is, I've been mentioning one of these spots that would show us a kind of an example historically of how this plays out when a city gets destroyed. Well, that's this spot here. In this particular location, we have one of their temple spaces, one of their worship sites. All these stones are stacked up as they were excavated, but as they were pulling the rock down, the stone would fall over, and so they would put it back up. This is some sort of worship space. It is not worship as practiced by the Israelites, but whoever occupied it after them built this there, and so they left it because it's part of the archaeological remains of the space. Here's another example of it. This site here particularly is Hazor, which is mentioned in the biblical accounts a couple different times, but of note for us, it was thoroughly destroyed and burnt by fire. And you see this little line right there? This is the spot where I talked before how they put this little black line. So everything below that black line is original to the destruction or the burning of Hazor at a time that is contemporary to the event mentioned in the Bible. So if you're looking for, like, hey, did that happen and was it there? That's the spot where Hazor was raised to the ground and burnt. It was burnt at a time that that line represents. And then they excavated it and they left that burn line. Now, in some places, this burn line isn't artificial. They left the actual blackened burn and they built on top of it with the modern soil to rebuild some of these walls. So it's probably going to be easily one of the most obviously connected sites you're going to find, where it says this happened here, this happened at that space. We're recognizing it here. Let's see. Some of the things that you might recognize in the story of this. Let me switch forward to Hazor. It's near the location of the Danites, who had their own little offshoot section of the kingdom. We're going to find out why in just a second. And Hazor itself was one of the last fortified surviving cities during the close of the captive space, before they were all carried off into captivity. Did you ever wonder why the Danites wanted to be off in a different area? This is why. Way off top, you go to the Tel Dan area, the Tel Dan National Park, and all of a sudden it's full of abundant, beautiful streams. You could go kayaking if you wanted to. There's actually a whitewater tour company that runs off of one of the rivers up on this side of Israel. It's lush, it's beautiful, and it's cool. And so the temperature drops probably a good 15 degrees when you get into this little section of the mountainside. And so it kind of makes a lot of sense. Like, oh, okay, now I know why they're all the way off, seemingly off on the edge in some ways. It's nice there. It's actually quite pleasant. Unfortunately, it's also the site of a lot of idolatry. This particular location is the spot where the golden calves at Dan would have been set. This is the actual location. This is the spot. This is the ground. This is the dirt. They actually have, you can kind of see it here, up in this representation of some metal they've built to represent the horns of the altar. So that's where the horns would be, that you, if it was a city of refuge, you'd go and grab the horns of that idol and try to save yourself from what was taking place. Scooting from the Old Testament side of things, there's also one of the sites from the New Testament side. Caesarea Philippi is a Roman name for it. It exists because on the backside of this mountain, there is an underground river that comes out right at the front of it. And so that creates this particular beautiful stream coming through. And up back in the corner, it is a location of a series of idols put to the deity Pan, which is a cultural deity from that northern section. This spot right here is an overlook of the core valley. Most likely is the spot where possibly Jesus would have appeared to the Saul of Tarsus, kind of location there from our New Testament. And so if you're looking down the valley, there's a road right there. That's the same historical road that travels the same route. All right, so we got one more set of things. This here is the Jordan River. You want to know who that guy is next to the other guy? I'm that guy, but who's the other guy? Auburn basketball coach. Happened to be there getting baptized in the Jordan River the day that I was there. And so for you Auburn fans, there you go. You never know who you're going to find when you go to Israel. They surprise you by different folks. Here we have, kind of our looking at things, though, some action around this whole area. This particular site right here, one of the excavations, let's get a little closer to it, is right on the edge of the Mediterranean. And so this Mediterranean space had a huge fortress built up around it that eventually would be turned into a lot of the space that Herod the Builder, Herod the Great, would build around, including some of these excavations here. This actually is from a different site, got slipped out of order. But these excavations here, that's the one that I want. So this is the view from one of those spots. There's Daniel Chandler showing up again. He's actually using something here. I took this picture on purpose, and I have permission from Daniel to use it from time to time. These Roman cities were notable because they include plumbing, right? Rome brought plumbing to this area. And bathrooms were not private. Roman bathrooms, public bathrooms. And so he's actually sitting on a Roman toilet. That's a Roman throne, I guess, if you want to go that way. And so there's actually a whole row of them, one on either side, and you look across the way to somebody else. We're accustomed to what we're accustomed to. And so our own comfort zones and experiences are going to be wildly different. I just thought it was interesting to kind of have that there. They were gender segregated. They were not... in most of the larger Roman cities. Remember, all the Roman outposts were mostly males that were sent, and then they would encounter the female population of that area and eventually intermarry with those cultures. So most of the Roman armies are heavily male-centric, and they had their followers to hang on. All right, so that covers all the main photos. So I got a few more for that. Before I go, these extra stuff I've got at the end of this, you guys have any questions of things that I rushed over a little bit or things that you were interested in? That is the beautiful Mediterranean Sea. It is as pretty as you ever thought it was going to be. So you're like, oh, it looks pretty in those photos. It's stunning in person. And you absolutely want to take your feet down and just stand there and let the water wash over your toes because it's that pretty. This particular site, from where you're standing in this photo, if you were to look to your left, is one of the likely places that Paul was being held before he was sent to Rome. There is a prison space below the remains of Herod's palace there. That's where Paul would have been positioned prior to his embarkment and heading off to Rome as his trial produced forward. To the right would have been the rest of the remains of the large city there. There used to be a large seawall out there to reduce the waves that make that a very pleasant port space. That's why it existed. To the left and a little bit out to sea was Herod's personal swimming pool, also part of that wall structure for the sea walls. Rich.
So you've kind of gone from Jericho to Hazor to Dan. What kind of distance are we looking there? So if I were to like travel that by foot, because
what's a different thing? So kind of Israel's small.
Because Joshua conquered Jericho and Hazor, and so I'm thinking, wow, okay, that's quite a campaign.
They're not that far apart. So to get from Hazor to Jericho by bus, accounting for having to drive around in different ways to make sure we went through the right zones, it's only like an hour, hour and a half.
Okay.
Took more time going through like the turnstiles at some of these places than actually driving between some of these locations. And also we went a couple different days. So this was just one day. This is us going out and back. But they're very close to one another. And if you look at your map and you see Israel there, do this one day. Take Israel and then take Delaware and realize that Delaware is bigger. Kind of, especially the populated side. I'm doing that off the top of my head, kind of thinking the map, but they're really similar in size. But I think Delaware is slightly larger than physical Israel. It's a small, small country surrounded by big, big countries. But it had a lot of stuff happen over multiple generations of life. A super pleasant to see us because we bring them money. So for 3 years in COVID, they had no tourism of substance. And so when we got there, they were like, hey, hello, hey, how you doing? Come on in. Doesn't matter what their background is. The Palestinian Christians, the Muslims, the Jews, they're all super happy to see people from Europe, people from America, people from South America, people from Japan. There's multicultural groups there all the time. And when you go to areas that are maybe a little less controlled, you can tell that they care about it because either the military police shows up or the Palestinian police show up and they maintain order very well. And so in the scale of like being worried about kind of stuff like that and how they're going to treat you, I got treated worse in France than I've gotten treated anywhere else. And everywhere I got treated in the Middle East, I was treated superbly. And they're just super happy to see you. And most of the time, they speak three languages. We went into a thrift store in 2019, not a thrift store, like a little shop in 2019. That shop employed staff that spoke not just multiple languages, but multiple languages with accents to match where you were from. So they could tell that when Alan and I got there that we were from the South, they turned on their Southern accent. And I'm like, oh, come on. But it was good. They did a good job of it. And then all of them speak three or four different languages. So, like, they're happy to see you. I will say, though, that the areas in the Palestinian Authority, they were much even more enthusiastic to see us than in the actual Israelite areas. They were happy to have our money there, not so much us. So they had, like, different responses. The Palestinian areas, when they see the Americans, they don't necessarily believe everything you see on TV about how they're going to see Americans. It's a little bit different there, especially the Christian minority in those Palestinian areas. So, Donna?
I noticed there's in your pictures there was a lot of excavation going on. Is that by the government or is that by individual people trying to?
So inside any Israelite Zone A space that's fully Israel controlled, there is no non-state-sanctioned archaeology taking place, period. You can't take anything from there. You can't officially touch anything from there without the state saying yes or no. In Zone C, it's the Wild West to a degree, in that you can have individuals doing archaeology, but they don't really do good archaeology. They do, let me grab some stuff and sell it, because they have to have money. In Zone B, which is the group-controlled areas where most of the older sites exist, it's a mixture of state-controlled and donor-based archaeology. Those sites, there's somebody that coordinates it, but you can go into their refuge pile of stuff they've already scrapped through and take the pottery shards that you want and then take them home with you. So it just kind of depends on where you're at. Most of the country is Zone A, which is true Israel-controlled. Some of it is Zone B, which is mutually controlled, like Temple Mount, is mutually controlled Zone B. And then Zone C is entirely Palestinian controlled. And it kind of varies a little bit, but that's the Wild West area.
Okay.
Other questions? Can you get kosher McDonald's there? Yes, you can. And it's totally kosher meals. They serve it without any of the dairy products on it. And it tastes wildly different than what you think McDonald's would taste like. Picture it this way. American cheeseburger at a McDonald's is about this big, right? About that big. They're about this big for a burger there at the kosher McDonald's. Just no cheese. So if you want cheese, you got to bring your own. They won't provide it for you because it's a true kosher kitchen. Any kosher restaurant in Israel has two kitchens in it, one for dairy products and that side, and the other one for any meat products, and nothing is supposed to cross between them. And they get checked regularly to meet those kosher dietary laws. And yes, you can get tacos there too. It's about when. So they serve them where they're not being mixed. So you'll have a meal that has meat, vegetables, potatoes, and then a meal that has no meat. It might have dairy, cheeses, as you'll see in a second. And you can see sometimes here there's a bunch of cheese in that. This is an Israelite Samaritan meal. It's the best meal we had. 100%. 1,000 times better than any meal I've had over there was this particular meal there. It's barbecue chicken on like spiced bread.
Did you find any tacos? I see what Mexican
hat. They have a taco chain in Israel. The answer to that is yes. So this was a buffet, like a full service meal that was there in Samaria. A lot of stuff is very similar. You've got hummus there, fresh hummus, which is throughout the whole region, all very good. In answer to your cheese question, this is my 7 types of cheese breakfast I had one morning. So you got cheesecake, chocolate cheesecake, cheese bread, fried cheese, cheese in your omelet, and another cheese bread Danish thing. So they got all kinds of cheese, as you can possibly imagine, and a few other things. Lots of olives are served there in different stuff. You know, their buffets are full of all those dairy stuff, but it's never served at the same time as a meat would be served. And so the dairies appear either on a separate bar or at an entirely separate time than any of the meat sections. All right, so that's about our time. The clock kind of says we're close to 7:46. I feel like that's our time there, too. Is that right? Did everyone lose track of time? I know I lost track of time. If you've got extra questions about any of this, I've got another 2,000 photos that we can talk about. This is just a few of those. And this is even like only half of as many photos as we did this a couple years ago when Alan and I did it. We had about 200 photos, and this is about 70. So happy to sit and talk for hours on end about any of these things. Going forward, just so you know what's going on in this Bible class, Rich Brown is going to start teaching Wednesday night in an overview of the major prophets. I'm sure he's got some things that will be valuable for you. And as we've already noted, he'll be teaching closer to the crowd, I think, because he's really hoping that you will participate in the dialogue. And so I'm sure he's going to talk about that, too. Thanks, everybody.